Case number 13-5281, American Meat Institute et al. Appellants versus United States Department of Agriculture et al. Ms. Stetson for the appellants, Mr. Tenney for the appellees.
Ms. Stetson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kate Stetson. Representing the appellants, I have Judy Coleman and Elizabeth Prelager with me at my counsel table. We are here on an appeal this morning from the denial of a preliminary injunction in the case below. I'd like to start with the First Amendment issue because I think the case can begin and end there, both on the merits and on, of course, the likelihood of irreparable harm. Because if you all conclude, as we think you should, that there is a First Amendment violation in hearing in these regulations, irreparable harm is established. The issue between the two parties in this case, of course, comes down to what standard to apply in the end. Is it the Zouderer standard or is it Central Hudson? Our argument is that R.J. Reynolds, or R.J.R., solved that question. What R.J.R. said was that Zouderer only applies when the government has demonstrated a real or at least self-evident deception or possibility of deception towards the consumers. The problem with the government's argument is that the government doesn't yet apparently think that standard applies here. The government's argument in its brief is exactly, and when I say exactly, I mean verbatim, the argument that the government's brief made in RJR, in which it lost. According to the government, a disclosure standard is subject to, you know, what the government calls a relaxed standard of review, the rational basis standard that Zouderer uses, or maybe even something else, I don't know. The problem is, after R.J. Reynolds, that question is no longer open to debate.
Well, it sort of depends on whether that's the holding of R.J.R. or dictum in that case. And in R.J.R., they are quite clear that, quote, this case raises novel questions about the scope of the government's authority to force the manufacturer to go beyond making purely factual and accurate commercial disclosures and undermine its own economic interests. In this case, by making every single pack of cigarettes a mini billboard in the government's anti-smoking message. And then in a footnote, it distinguishes Zouderer on the ground that in Zouderer, all they were doing was prescribing orthodox advertising, not orthodox in matters of opinion. And they said that RJR is a different case because it was orthodoxy in matters of opinion. And they later say on the next page that the government's seeks to compel a product's manufacturing when the government seeks to compel a product's manufacturer to convey the state's subjective and perhaps even ideological view that consumers should reject this otherwise legal but disfavored product.
That is all in RJR. You are correct.
Yes.
The issue there, Chief Judge Garland, is that, you know, when I described the quote from RJR, that wasn't just this panel talking. What the court said in RJR is Zouderer, Ibanez, and Milovetz, all three Supreme Court cases, establish that a disclosure requirement is only appropriate if the government shows that absent a warning there is a self-evident or at least potentially real, quote, danger that an advertisement will mislead consumers. So this isn't just a standard that the D.C. Circuit has come up with from whole cloth and applied only in RJR. This is straight from the Supreme Court. And there is,
well,
we
none
submit,
of those cases say what you're saying. That is, they are all, some of them are cases where they describe situations of deception and say that that is covered by a lower standard. But there are plenty of statements in Zouder, for example, that suggest that that's just what happened to be in that case. And the issue is whether this is simply straightforward statements of facts or whether it is in the commercial field and disclosure rather than when it's something more like restriction as compared to disclosure. The Second Circuit, of course, takes the other position.
It does.
Twice.
Yes.
So, and interpreting the same Supreme Court opinions, but in cases in which they are, I think, fairly described as holdings because they were required, while in our case, they weren't required because there was considerable difference between the cigarette package labeling and what's at issue here.
There is a factual difference, I will grant you, between the cigarette package labeling and what's at issue here. But when you point out the Second Circuit decision, the dissent in RJR, of course, cited the Second Circuit's decision in Sorrell quite extensively. The government in this brief and in its RJR brief cites the Second Circuit's decision in Sorrell quite extensively. With RJR and, I submit, with Spirit Airlines, we're past that. The question in front of this court, under this court's precedence, is does this particular fact pattern fall into the very narrow Zouderer exception, or is it subject to Central Hudson review? And I want to pause on that for a minute. No one is suggesting, contrary to some statements in the interveners and the government's briefs, that labeling is not subject to any standard of review. We are simply suggesting that when the government has not offered an interest other than, you know, perhaps arguably an interest of certain consumers in obtaining more specific information about a product, that labeling is subject to Central Hudson review.
Can we just explore that? Your argument appears to require invalidation of the statute as well as the regulation. Why isn't that the case?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and we've of course preserved in the complaint and in our briefing the notion that the statute may also have some First Amendment infirmities.
Well, I'm just talking about the principle that you're advocating. It seems to me that principle dooms the statute.
It may well doom the statute, Your Honor, but what we are here challenging is the regulation that's giving rise to our harm.
How do we distinguish it so that we would not, in the next case, the statute, just to take the introductory part of the statute, forget about the four categories, says, a retailer of a covered commodity shall inform consumers of the country of origin of the covered commodity. Constitutional or unconstitutional in your view?
We would submit unconstitutional, which is why we preserved both in our complaint and in the
briefing. So we know that if we take your argument, we have to hold this statute unconstitutional.
We have to be ready to hold it.
We have to be ready to hold it unconstitutional.
You have to be ready in the next case if it is brought to hold that statute unconstitutional. But let me make a point on that. Nobody challenged this statute before this case. Nobody challenged the prior regulation before this case. This industry that we are here representing was willing to tolerate, even though, as you can tell from all of the declarations that were filed in this case, they suffered significant losses under the 2009 final.
I don't see how that matters to our legal analysis. The question for us is, if we adopt your view, all country of origin labeling has to go down when the next person comes in. In other words, if a manufacturer in a country wants to go without a label so that people, maybe they think that it's American made, then they can do that. As long as they don't deceptively say it's American made, in your view, they can go without a label, right?
But that may well distinguish some other labeling scheme from this one. The remarkable thing about this labeling scheme, and you can see this at Joint Appendix 512, is that there was no interest asserted by the agency when it put this particular labeling regime together, and there is none in the statute.
I want to stick with the statute for the
moment. There is no interest stated in the statute either.
Well, it's not quite right. So I looked, and it seems obvious to me what the point was. That is, I looked at it, and it seems like this is America first. That is, we're going to buy America, and we're worried about the possibility that we'll learn that there's a disease outbreak in some country, and they'll want to know whether the products we have that we're buying come from that country. And lo and behold, when I look at the motion to instruct the conferees on the original statute, the Farm Security Act of 2001, the two sponsors of the bill, Bono and Hooley, both say that's the purpose. The purpose is I want to make sure that there are consumers who want to make sure that it is grown in a place that is safe, and there are consumers who want to make sure to support American agriculture and buy American. Now, assume for the moment that those are the reasons. Are you saying that those are not sufficient reasons? If Congress thinks that there are Americans who, as a matter of their patriotic duty, believe they should buy American, that it would be unconstitutional to require a disclosure rule that would let them know whether it's American. And likewise, if they have a view that they don't want to buy from a certain country because they're not confident that it goes through the same review that our things in this country go through, that they shouldn't, that it would be improper to have a rule that requires disclosure of that.
There are a few different levels of answer. The first is the Buy American interest is not constitutional. The health and safety interest,
not constitutional because?
Because there is no compelling government interest in
enforcing
the law.
Where does compelling come from? That sounds like strict scrutiny now.
No, it's straight from this court's decision in RJR applying Central Hudson, which in turn took it from Philip Morris from this court's
decision.
And
you think is compelling the same as strict scrutiny?
No, it is not.
What's the word that we use when we use strict scrutiny?
I believe the words you use are compelling interest, but the standard is narrower in terms of tailoring.
So it's compelling, but not really. Not really compelling.
Let's call it substantial interest.
Ah, that's what I thought the rule was. That's what Central Hudson says.
Well, Philip Morris also talks about compelling interest in the Central Hudson framework. Mm-hmm. But let's call it substantial interest. Mm-hmm. There is no, and I want to back up two steps because I think we are getting far afield, and I'm happy to be in that field.
I don't think we're in a different field. I think this is what we have to worry about, what's going to happen when somebody brings the next case, and you're telling us that the rationale for origin labeling is not sufficiently compelling, substantial, et cetera, to uphold.
I understand. But what we're also arguing is that in order to fit within the Zouderer rationale, the entity promulgating the standard, whether it is the agency or Congress, needs to show an evident risk of deception. But let's talk about health and safety and Buy American. Buy American.
Do you think that's true for health and safety as well? Why isn't that true for, or is it not? You say health and safety is different. Why?
I think why if there was proof of a health and safety issue, you could satisfy Central Hudson.
Uh-huh.
But
so
you know the
health
whole
and safety
purpose,
never comes under Zouder. Is that your view?
Not in this court, and not in the Supreme Court. That's the point of RJR. That's the point RJR made. Zouderer has never been applied, the Zouderer standard, by the Supreme Court in anything other than a deception case. And the reason, when you think about commercial speech in the first instance, the reason becomes clear. Some commercial speech already is subject to a lesser, more mushy standard of review. So if every commercial speech gave rise to the possibility of some government interest, you'd always have a Zouderer standard controlling, but that's not the way it works. Zouderer attaches...
With respect to disclosures, not with respect to restrictions.
Yes, but that distinction already also has gone by the wayside, Chief Judge Garland. The fact is, in this court, under the National Association of Manufacturers case,
you're
under RJR,
about,
under Spirit.
National Association of Manufacturers, the labor case, right?
The labor case.
That's an interpretation of a section of the National Labor Relations Act, right?
That's correct.
Right.
That's
not,
correct.
Not an interpretation of the First Amendment, although it used First Amendment points. It was
did,
not.
It did, but one of the things that case said, and I believe it cited RJR for this principle, mm-hmm. is that you know, whether you are compelling speech or restricting it, the First Amendment standard remains the same. This is a saw that the Second Circuit candidly has bought into, that the government would like you to buy into, that when you're compelling speech, the standard for First Amendment is somehow different than when you are restricting it.
No, but when you're compelling a factual disclosure, I don't think it's just compelling speech.
But that gets you into, again, the purpose of the factual disclosure, Judge Srinivasan. Then you have to ask the question, you know, what interest does the government have in compelling this particular factual disclosure? There is no health or safety interest. The government has affirmatively and repeatedly disclaimed the idea that there is a health or safety problem with labeling beef from different countries, labeling pork from different countries. That is completely off the table. What we are left with in this case is the interest that the agency has put forward to justify the regulation that is operating on these appellees, that is subject to enforcement against them, and that is causing them their immediate harm.
Can I ask you a question your interest, your expressive interest? So am I right in assuming that you would have the same objection to this regulatory regime if what it called for is for reporting to the government with no disclosure at all? But it included the same information, so you have to go through the same four steps, and you have to file a report with the government that tells them, here's the pieces of meat that I've dealt with, and here's the category into which each one falls.
we would have the same problem if it called for merely reporting to the government without public disclosure. It gets you a little bit closer to some of the SEC disclosure cases where the disclosure at issue just went to the agency, but that's, of course, not
so this is not a case like RJR where the entities that were subject to the compelled disclosure objected to the content of the what they were being compelled to disclose.
Oh, no. We made it clear in our briefing and in many of the declarations that we also object to portions of the disclosure themselves. Many of our declarants, for example, and this is in a footnote in our brief, observed that when you talk about production points, which is not required by the statute, and you talk about born, raised, or slaughtered, the word slaughtered, to put it mildly, is off-putting.
But the regulation allows the industry to substitute harvested.
It does indeed allow substitution of the word harvested, yes.
Milder. Not sure.
Not particularly apropos for
but
our
not harmful,
particular
But not harmful to you. It's at most head-scratching.
Yes,
but
to Judge Srinivasan's point, if the question is, you know, is this speech with which we disagree, the first answer, A, is we don't need to show that. We just need to show that we're being compelled to speak, which we are. But the second answer, to the extent it matters, is that, yes, we are objecting to that particular mode of speech.
That's the extent of it. And that was in a footnote in your reply brief, if I'm remembering correctly.
That was in a footnote in at least our reply brief and perhaps in our opening brief
as well. Can I just check with this for one moment? So this means if the government, if this went down and the government says, well, we want to know, you don't have to advertise it, but we want you to tell us, that would be unconstitutional also because it would be compelling somebody to report to the government?
It is possible that that would be unconstitutional also,
all reporting requirements, economic reporting requirements, all of them? There must be a million kinds of reporting requirements.
Not in the least, uh-huh. Chief Judge Garland, uh-huh. because remember, one of my earliest answers mm-hmm. was, we are not suggesting that it is unconstitutional full stop to require a disclosure.
No, you're suggesting that for each of these there has to be a full hearing with evidence on the record. Each kind of the millions of reporting requirements that the government imposes on American business would be subject to Central Hudson review, regard as requiring compelling government interest.
I think we agreed to call it substantial government interest, but yes.
Why do you go so far in extending your claim? I mean, it strikes me as unnecessary, right? I mean, in being required to utter something to the world at large, it seems to be a much broader curtailment of your rights than being required to tell something to some government official who will probably not look at it.
I think that is absolutely right, and that's why, you know, in after a fashion, I tried to resist both of your colleagues' hypotheticals. To the extent that we had a hypothetical in front of us where the only disclosure was to the government, I think that it arguably still would be unconstitutional if the government didn't articulate a substantial interest. But, of course, Judge Williams, that's not...
Well, substantial interest. I mean, that seems to be clearly more than minimum rationality.
Absolutely, yes.
How do you get to that for this simple disclosure to the government?
For a simple disclosure to the government, again, we're operating in the hypothetical world because that's not this case. The question then would be, is that disclosure a public disclosure?
It's not even commercial speech at that point. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's not even commercial speech at that point if you're just making a disclosure to the government.
It may or may not be, depending on, you know, there are varying interpretations of what constitutes commercial speech. Speech with an economic interest attached to it at its broadest, that still might be commercial speech. But if I may return from the hypothetical to the actual, Judge Williams, in this case, where you have disclosure to the public of information where the government's only articulated interest in the record is of more specific information, that simply does not pass muster under the Constitution. This does not mean that every disclosure requirement is going to be struck down. It may not even mean that every country of origin labeling requirement is going to be struck down if the government does its homework. What the government could have done...
What would its homework consist of? That seems to be a critical point.
Well, what it would consist of...
Here it's unusual in the sense that the agency itself conceded that there was no market failure. There was every reason to believe that the market itself would generate an optimal level. Maybe the government wants more than optimal.
of information, yes.
But, and the government doesn't have a single, nobody appeared suggesting they were yearning to get this information. So it's,
correct, again.
It's extraordinary. But what would be necessary? What would satisfy you?
Something like that, I think. If the government had come forward and said, we have people, just like in Spirit Airlines, we have dozens, hundreds of people who claim that they are being misled and deceived by the labeling as it currently exists on muscle-cut meat products sold at retail. Here is the evidence of consumers in the record, just like in Spirit, just like in RJR, that we have concluded supports our finding that this is deceptive or misleading. This prior labeling regime, which, by the way, the government instituted, is deceptive or misleading, so we're going to change it. But that's not what the government said. Even when asked by several commenters, what is your First Amendment justification for this rule? All the government said is, A, we have the authority, and B, we're going to implement this rule to provide more specific information to the consumers. That's at Joint Appendix 512. Now, to your point, Judge Williams, about market failure, I agree it's extraordinary. That's at Joint Appendix 519. What the government said here is there's no evidence that the market can't take care of information flow itself. To me, that reads like an utter concession that this particular rule, which the government said on the second page of its final rule, already delivers comparatively small economic benefits on top of the small economic benefits conferred by the 2009 rule, is useless. There is no value to it that consumers see or that the government sees. And on
well,
the other side of the ledger,
does not appear to be a compelling market failure argument. Now, they may not, the writer of this may not have heard the interchange between me and you as to whether compelling means substantial or substantial means compelling. And in the next section, they explain what they think is a problem, that these attributes of meat, they explain, consumers would not otherwise be able to obtain information on or verify by inspection of the product at the point of purchase. I completely agree that there's some, shall we say, tension between the middle column and the third column of this Federal Register page, but it may depend on the words like compelling, which you are reading to mean satisfy your test. They may not understand that they're looking at a First Amendment test question here.
Well, except that when the government goes on that same page, and I believe this is what Judge Williams was pointing to, the evidence suggests that market mechanisms could ensure that the optimal level of country of origin information would be provided to the degree valued by consumers. And, of course, in this case, there was no such evidence that consumers valued this at all, even assuming that in mere interest in more specific information about that particular product qualifies as an interest, which the Second Circuit has said does not.
Can we pursue two aspects of that, substantive and procedural? I think you spoke of consumers testifying in the Spirit Airlines procedure saying that they were deceived. Was that an on-the-record rulemaking in a technical APA sense?
It was in the administrative record in the pure APA sense.
Was there actual consumers who came up and said under oath, I've been deceived?
No, what the FAA did in that case was to draw from several, and this is in the first few pages of Judge Tatel's decision in that case, what the agency did in that case was to draw from several different sources of consumer discontent. It had a forum that it administered, that it drew comments from.
Okay.
It had
so
comments submitted in support of a prior rulemaking.
All right. Just to make sure I understand.
Sure.
You aren't proposing that the evidentiary record to support this sort of disclosure requirement would have to be based on so-called technical on-the-record rulemaking, right? With the people testifying and having cross-examination and so forth.
No. Presumably what could happen is that which happened in Spirit Airlines and which was found ample, and that which did not occur in RJR. You know, one of the points that the court in RJR made was that the only interest asserted in the record in that particular case had to do with an interest in reducing smoking rates.
That's the procedural matter.
Correct.
On the substance, suppose you have a bunch of consumers saying, I'd really like to know, I just want to know where my meat comes from. Is that enough?
No, it's not under Amistad.
So suppose they say, I'd really like to know because I'm suspicious of the regulatory mechanisms in Canada and Mexico about the way in which cattle are brought up and so forth. Is that enough?
No, it's not enough to compel speech. The government can't indulge irrationality, and what that is...
Is that necessarily irrational?
Oh, it is completely irrational, and something that the government has conceded, and I suspect would concede again here, there is no health or safety issue respecting any of the products that we are talking about.
Well,
the regulatory regimes in Mexico and Canada are the same as those here. They are subject to the same inspection
standards
as here.
What if there's an outbreak of mad cow disease in Canada, and there is food on the shelves that is in combination, that is, this commingled. And a person under those circumstances wants to know whether the meat that they're about to buy came from Canada, they don't know where in Canada, or from the United States.
That, of course, has occurred in recent years.
So
and the Food Safety Inspection Service, not the marketing service in charge of labeling, shut down the Canadian border, took the meat off the shelves, and resolved the
problem. But how would they know what meat that is already on the shelves came that way? As I understand, under the current rule, there's no labeling requirement for the commingled meat processed on the same day, correct?
That's correct. And under the statute, there's flexibility for commingled.
Well, leave aside the flexibility just for the moment.
Right.
Imagine that we vacate this rule and the commingling from before is allowed. And on the shelves, there's now meat that doesn't say that it's from Canada because it wasn't required to. And an American consumer wants to know whether to buy that meat or not. He can't know. She can't know, right? Because it's not labeled. And not only can they not know, but the processors don't know because, as you said, they commingle.
Chief Judge Garland, what we are talking about is a health and safety hypothetical that is solvable through other administrative mechanisms and has been solved through other mechanisms and was never present for very good reason in this agency's justification for this regulation.
How is it solved in the example I just gave?
It is solved by the actions of the Food Safety Inspection Service and others who undertake to take meat off the shelves.
Well, how do they know? How do they know? I mean, you told Judge Srinivasan you couldn't even be required to disclose this to the Food Safety Administration in advance. So how would they know, since it's all processed on the same day? How would they know the answer to this question?
Judge Garland, I'm confident that they would, and I'm happy
You're asking me to take you on speculation, but not the government.
I am not, because I am happy to supply some follow-up material about the steps that are taken whenever a health or safety risk presents itself. The reason, of course, that's not in our briefing is because it's not germane to this conversation. This conversation has to do with the rule that the agency promulgated and the reasons that the agency advanced. The agency has never said, and in fact,
the agency
affirmatively
doesn't have to say, if, as in Spirit and the other cases say, that if we can tell from what Congress has done, it's not necessary for the agency to say. And as I said, at least some members of Congress who supported the bill had two concerns. One was a health concern and one was a Buy America concern. And it seems to me that this is quite common sense, that somebody would like to know, either because they want to buy America, you say that's not compelling. I don't know whether I agree with that. Maybe it's substantial and not compelling. Maybe it's good enough and not compelling or substantial. But if you take this away, it seems to me you eliminate the easiest way to protect a consumer. Yes, there may be harder ways to protect consumers, but the easiest way is to know that the label on the beef is from a country that just had an outbreak.
Well, the other issue, though, Chief Judge Garland, is that the source of the problem that you're identifying, and again, I do need to emphasize that we're not talking about health and safety issues except through this hypothetical. The issue that you've identified springs not from the label, but from commingling. and commingling, and this starts shading over into our statutory argument and our APA argument, commingling and the elimination of commingling is not within the agricultural marketing services grasp. The job of the AMS...
You're fading off of my hypothetical. Assume for the moment that we don't think there is any commingling or non-commingling requirement here from a process point of view, that we accept the government's position that all they've done is a labeling rule, that what you can't do is commingle labels. You can figure out any way you want to, but we're not controlling the process. We're just requiring a label. Now, seems a lot easier for a consumer to look on the label and say, well, that's from a country that just had an outbreak. I don't want to go there.
Your Honor, I need to push back first against the government's representation. You know, this rule eliminates commingling. It says so on nearly every operative page of the final rule. Commingling is used 131 times.
Yes, and I have to say I've read almost every one of those, and in each case, I think in context, it's clear that what they mean by commingling is the way in which you label, not that they are in any place requiring these things to be in separate places.
No, that's why the government, that's why the AMS uses, eliminates the practice of commingling. That's not labeling. That is the practice of commingling.
Can you tell me the page that you're citing from?
Certainly. Joint Appendix 509 eliminates the allowance for commingling.
Right, but the allowance for commingling in context is the allowance to label commingling. It's not an allowance to process in a particular way.
Yes,
it's a requirement that you label.
But, Your Honor, if this rule did not eliminate both the allowance for and the practice of commingling, there would not have been spent as many pages as there were in the final rule explaining the vast economic consequences of eliminating the practice of commingling.
Yes, but isn't that because the effect of the labeling rule is to make it difficult, if not impossible, to physically commingle, but not because they have a rule about physical commingling.
The agency understood exactly what it was doing when it eliminated commingling. The effect of the rule, the elimination of commingling, essentially drives the rest of the rule. It's completely backwards. The Agricultural Marketing Service has the power to prescribe what's on a label, not to prescribe changes in the production regime.
Yeah, but there must be quite a few situations where the labeling requirements have implications for the method of production.
That's right? True. And assuming that they were as broad and grave and costly as these here, the government would have cited them in its brief, and it didn't. Here, the effect of the commingling, eliminating commingling, is evident by the number of times, 131, that word comes up in this final rule. This is a final rule about eliminating commingling, not about labeling.
Does that distinction, is that one with a difference for you? So if what we think is that the government said you have to do your labeling in a particular way, everybody in the industry appreciates that the predictable consequence of that is that there's going to be cut back on commingling because...
Everybody in the industry and the agency appreciated that this would eliminate the practice of commingling,
Right, but it would have the consequence of eliminating commingling because of the labeling requirements. So the driver is the labeling.
The driver is the labeling, but that's, as we said to the district court below, that is the smallest tail wagging the biggest dog. This is an industry, a vast upstream industry change, changes in packing and processing practices, changing in contracting, all of which are prompted by a labeling regime that we say both is violative of the Constitution and, to our APA point, doesn't even come within the statutory text. The statutory text actually supplies the kind of flexibility to permit commingling where the regulation doesn't. That's why there's such a misjoinder.
Which statutory text are you relying on that allows commingling?
So I'm looking at, and this is in our brief on pages 8 to 9, if you look at, for example, category B meat, multiple countries of origin, the two things that I'd want you to focus on are may and or, the disjunctive or.
So I'd like you to focus on two things, and the.
Okay.
A retailer of a covered commodity that is derived from an animal.
Yes.
I'll take your may designate the country in which the animal may have been born, raised, or slaughtered.
May have been.
Yeah.
Born, raised, or slaughtered.
Well, let's leave aside for the moment. So now what we're talking about, to be clear, is animals that were processed on the same day, right? One of which is a Canadian animal, one of which is an American animal, right? And you think they can be described as, with the commingling rule, they would be described as product of Canada and the United States.
Or right? Product of the U.S. and Canada, depending, yes.
Right. But it doesn't. It says an animal and the animal. It doesn't say anything about all the animals processed on a particular day can be described this way. It says, yes, you have an animal. The animal may be described in this way, but it doesn't say anything about animals on a particular day.
No, I don't think that an and the carry the weight that that is necessary to pull off the distraction from may and may have been. May and may have been, and this is something that the former general counsel of the Department of Agriculture understood, those words
Pause over this. The fact that the former general counsel in another administration interpreted the rule in a particular way certainly doesn't mean that a new administration is stuck by a letter that former general counsel sent to Congress.
No, it does not. But I think it's significant because of the timing of that letter. The letter went to Congress before the final statute was passed, the 2008 Farm Bill was passed. And one of the things that...
But if we don't even look at legislative history...
Understood.
We're going to look at letters from general counsels to committees?
Yes, for this reason. What the agency's interpretation of the statute is now is so divergent from what it always has been. And it wasn't just that general counsel. It was the agency saying traditionally... Historically, commingling.
When did the agency say that?
In 2009.
Yes, January 15th, 2009, right?
Yes.
What's significant about that date?
I understand the significance of the date, but even an agency...
After the election and days before the inauguration. Now, you're certainly not taking the position that a new administration of either party can't change the interpretation that the previous administration came out with 2 weeks before the new administration takes over.
I'm not taking that position at all. What I am saying is that it can't change the statute. And what the statute says is may have been born, raised, or slaughtered. That kind of latitude is nowhere found in the regulation.
What do you think may have been? You think, like, speculatively? We can, like, herd lots of animals in here, and maybe these are from both? Really?
Yes, look at Category E. Look at ground beef. And this is one of the reasons why this deception rationale, by the way, is so faulty. Category E says you can, and this is in the final rule as well, you can label ground beef as any country that may have been involved in that particular product.
That says a list of all reasonably possible countries. That's what that statute says.
Reasonably possible countries, and if it's within the last 60 days, we'll give you a pass.
Yes, but Congress used words, reasonably possible. That sounds a lot. If they wanted to say that, they could have said that in B.
Well, the process, shall we say, is different when it comes to slaughtering muscle cuts of meat. Yeah. That's why it says may have been born, raised, and slaughtered. But you know, the point is there is latitude in the statute that is nowhere present in the final rule. That's the first APA point.
I mean, the difficulty with latitude is Chevron, right?
No, but this is not the latitude we're talking about. I understand your point, but the latitude we're talking about isn't latitude on the agency's behalf.
No, that's the question.
It's latitude on the processor's behalf.
Can I reframe your argument?
Sure.
It is that, in effect, the department has read may have been as if it read has been. Is that correct?
As each of the processing points in through which the animal has passed, yes, has been born, raised, and slaughtered, which is why I mentioned the or before. Born, raised, and slaughtered. You need to put all of them on your label now. That's the difference. And that's, you know, from the APA perspective, we, of course...
In terms of the commingling, if I understand that point, which appears to be economically key, you're saying... think that the department has read out may have and replaced it with has. Is that correct?
It has read out may have and may have been and replaced it with has. It has read out or and replaced it with and. That's the problem. And that's the statutory textual problem. The other of the two APA problems that we identified is the one that we were talking about earlier, which is that this agricultural marketing service has arrogated to itself responsibility for governing production practices upstream. That's the APA issue, in short. Before I sit down, and so I don't waive it, I want to touch on the harm argument briefly, and I can be brief. It is not easy to see what more we could have done at the PI stage to establish the harm that is going to and is now befalling our members.
You're very clear on harm in
okay,
your brief.
Thank you.
I actually have one, Mrs. Dessen, before you sit down.
Sure.
Back on the First Amendment, sorry. So one of the amici makes the assertion that you don't actually represent retailers, that who you represent act on behalf of is somebody who's upstream from the retailers,
mm-hmm.
whereas the incidence of this regulatory regime falls upon retailers. So is that correct?
There are no retailers in our appellant group, but that's irrelevant to the First Amendment issue, Judge Srinivasan, mm-hmm. for at least two reasons. The first is sub E of the operative statute requires us to pass on information to the retailers, and to the extent that's not enough, at least one of our appellants, AgriBeef, labels its own products. For retail consumption.
It labels its own products, but is it the retailer that actually puts those out at the point of sale? Or does it just do that because the way the industry works is that it's helpful if somebody upstream actually packages it?
It is not the retailer at final point of sale, but it labels its products for retail consumption, as do many other
I don't understand what that means. I'm sorry. What does it mean it labels it for retail consumption? So, in other words, it prepackages everything, and then all the retailer at the point of sale has to do is pass on the package that
yes.
it's already received. Is that the difference?
Yes.
Whereas with everybody else but agribusiness.
No, not with everybody else but AgriBeef. That's the most evident example from the declarations. But there are others, depending on their size, depending on where they are in the chain, that either label their own products or at least pass on the information to retailers. But
and in the AgriBeef example, is AgriBeef the actual retailer at the point of sale, or is it somebody else?
No, AgriBeef is not a retailer.
So isn't it? It just seems strikes me a little bit odd to have a compelled speech case where the party that's complaining is not the party whose speech is being compelled.
Oh, no. Our speech is very much being compelled. That's why I mentioned sub E of the statute. We are required to speak on these issues in order that the retailers put information.
But does E require you to – what you're complaining about is the labeling in categories 1 through 4.
Yes.
And does E require you to actually have those labels?
Well, AgriBeef certainly has those labels. E requires us to pass on information specific enough so the retailer can have those labels. And this, by the way, there's not an argument that the government ever has raised, either below or here.
It's still a standing problem, I think, is the way that we have to think about this.
No, I don't think there's any standing problem.
I know you don't, but that's the question we're talking about.
First of all, because...
And that can't be waived.
I'm sorry?
And that can't be waived.
Understood. There's no standing problem for at least two reasons. The first is that the commingling ban in this regulation, of course, impacts us directly. The second
That's
is...
That's the APA argument? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes. It reads on the First Amendment argument only to the extent that if the First Amendment speech is being compelled here because in service of this commingling ban, the two tend to blend together a little bit. As for First Amendment, our speech is being compelled. AgriBeef's speech is being compelled. Our speech is being
Why is AgriBeef's? I take it they're not point of sale. Does the regulation compel them to put this label on it?
Their production practices historically require them to
voluntarily.
Yes, but that's voluntary.
Yes, but again, no. What these packers and processors do is to give information to the retailers so that the retailers know exactly now what particular cow passed through the process at what particular
time. Does E require that? If the answer is yes, then you're
yes.
finished. Yeah. So E requires that the suppliers provide the retailers with the same specific information that the retailer is going to have to provide later.
Correct.
I see.
That's correct. The retailers at that point are just a pass-through. And by the way, it's very clear how the retailers feel about this rule. You can look in the comments to the final rule to find what the retailers feel. Our harm is just as significant, if not more, than the retailers because of the nature of the upstream all the way to downstream speech that we're required to engage in on top of the colossal economic harms that these industry appellants are facing.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, starting on the First Amendment issue, the concern that's addressed in all of the cases that the other side is relying on is a concern about speech, about either somebody whose speech is being curtailed in some meaningful way or someone who's, and I can use Reynolds as an example, although this is throughout the cases. Reynolds talks about being forced to carry the messages of third parties where the messages themselves are biased against or are expressly contrary to the entity's views. That's what we're talking about.
How is that requirement satisfied in United Foods? I mean, there we seem to have a party, United Foods, which has different views from those reflected in the regulation as to the optimal way of promoting its products. It doesn't disagree with the message that mushrooms are good, right?
Well, I guess the only point we're making, and in this case, as the colloquy that recently, toward the end of opposing counsel's argument illustrates, the only point we're making is that you've got to be talking about someone who's saying that they've got a problem with the message or that their own message isn't coming out.
What I'm trying to ask you is how is the plaintiff's argument here, in terms of their problem with the message, different from the plaintiff's problem in United Foods?
Well, the big problem is that the vast majority of their argument relates to things they have to keep track of, costs of processing, which aren't First Amendment interests at all. You know, they say that there are some of them, and then in a footnote in their reply brief, they have an issue with the word slaughtered. But I don't understand them to be saying it. Even if they were saying it, would it be at most a minimal concern? And this gets back to the Zouderer point about factual information. I don't understand them to be saying the problem here is that we don't want people to know this information, or we think that giving people this information compromises our ability.
Okay, you're still not helping me on the distinction of United Foods.
Well, that was a...
The United Foods had no objection to the promotion of mushrooms. It thought it wanted to spend its money on its brand, which is fine, but that's not inconsistent with money being spent on mushrooms generically, right?
I mean, I think that's true, although their concern related to the nature of their advertising practices.
What is
in
this?
The advertising.
They're advertising. They could advertise whatever they like. It's the question of what the collective did by way of advertising. United Foods did not object to the message.
But so that this is the question.
Notwithstanding what Justice Kennedy said.
Well, that's what I wonder. Maybe you know more than it's very hard to tell from the opinion. It's this sentence. The question is whether, from United Foods, the question is whether the government may underwrite and sponsor speech with a certain viewpoint using special subsidies extracted from a designated class of persons, some of whom object to the idea being advanced. What were they objecting to?
I don't know enough about the facts to know exactly what they were objecting to, but the point that I'm making here is that when you're talking about these are advertisements that are going to be put out, you know, promoting your products, then there may be a First Amendment interest in controlling with your money, there may be a First Amendment interest in controlling the content of those advertisements. Here, the injury that they're asserting, it doesn't relate to their advertising. It doesn't relate to the promotion of their products. Except for this footnote in their reply brief, which was addressed in the regulation, and they didn't talk about that anywhere. They're not talking about the content of the message. They're not saying it's biased against them. They're not saying they have contrary views. They're saying none of that. What they're saying is it costs money for us to comply with this regulation.
Mr. Chang, what's the ultimate point of this line of argument? Is it that where the objection that's being asserted doesn't have to do with the content of the speech and doesn't have to do with concern that what we're being compelled to say misleads the audience or something like that? Where that is the case, what? Zouderer applies?
Yes. We're not saying there's no First Amendment at all. We're just saying that it's that the basis for having a heightened standard, like Central Hudson, which is not that heightened a standard, but more than Zouderer, the basis for that is all in circumstances where there is a burden on somebody's speech, where the speaker's own message is being compromised or where the speaker is being forced to adopt a message that is biased against them or...
I hear what you say. I just want to see you apply it to United Foods.
Well, I mean...
How does United Foods square with the principle you're asserting?
Well, I don't know. I just want to begin by saying I don't know enough about the facts of United Foods to know exactly how it worked. But, for example, you know, advertising in the commercial context is very complicated. And, for example, if you're promoting mushrooms generally, maybe that, you know, emphasizes, that detracts from the distinction between brands and mushrooms.
The opinion offers no example of how that would actually work out.
That's true, but the opinion also does make the statement quoted by Chief Judge Garland earlier. So I guess all I'm trying to say is the principle here is the First Amendment interest here is an interest in not disclosing factual and uncontroversial information, which the Supreme Court said in Zouderer is a minimal interest.
Assuming that, what is the interest on the other side? I mean, I don't understand the government to be arguing that a zero interest on the other side is adequate.
Right.
Which would take us into
the right. Right. The consumers have consistently expressed an interest in knowing where the food that they're eating comes from, and that was reflected both in the legislative history of the statute and in comments to every one of the rules that's been promulgated through the years. And the consumers have an interest in information, and I just wanted to note that we're not just talking about sort of misleading information in the Zouderer context, it's also incomplete information that consumers want to know more. That language was quoted in the Reynolds decision itself, and it's certainly present in the Milovic case where the assertion that the statement that was forced to be made was, we are a debt relief agency, we help people file for bankruptcy under the bankruptcy code. I don't think anybody there was seriously arguing that consumers had the misimpression that these people were not a debt relief agency or didn't help people. They just didn't know. So we're just talking about providing more information. And that's really
what's the best indication in the materials, the record or the legislative materials, that either Congress at the time that the statute was enacted or the agency at the time that the rules were promulgated was acting on that interest?
On the same page that, you know, we talked, there was a colloquy earlier about two columns of the same page. Like the column that we would refer to is the one that says numerous comments confirm that consumers have an interest in knowing where their meat is coming from. And that was listed as a benefit for the rule. Now, of course, since they've essentially conceded that their challenges to the statute, then you would go back to Congress is concerned, and then there's discussion of how consumers should know that, you know, they're buying American and so on, and some of that material was cited earlier and is in the briefing. And Congress, of course, under Turner, is not required to build an administrative record the likes of which an agency would have to build to defend a rule. So it's worth noting they are not bringing in this court an arbitrary and capricious challenge. So to the extent that their concern is about, you know, that they think the agency said one thing and then said another thing, that's not, we think, you know, there's explanations for all that, but that's not the challenge they brought. The challenge they brought is that the agency is without authority to do what it did, either as a statutory matter or as a constitutional matter, and we think that those arguments are wrong. I just, in response to the commingling point which was discussed, I just wanted to raise one point about the regulation itself. The operative portion of the regulation is, of course, the regulations themselves, which appear in the Code of Federal Regulations, not all the preamble discussion. And that appears on page 527 of the Joint Appendix. It's very short, it's like a column and a half or so. It says nothing about commingling. It says nothing about production practices. All it says is you have to label the meat based on the animal from which the meat was derived. And that's what the statute says, too. So although the consequences, you know, the way that they comply with the rule may affect the way they do their business, in terms of what the rule itself requires, that is set out on page 527 of the Joint Appendix, and that's entirely consistent with the statute.
What about opposing counsel's argument about may have been? Doesn't B, for example, leave it to the labeler to decide, may designate where it may have been? They can sort of speculate or guess, or at least where they know it's one of two or three places, they can label them all.
There's a few problems with that argument. One is that I think it's quite a reach to say that unambiguously precludes the agency from directing retailers to display the actual point of origin, particularly where it can be readily known. That maybe the agency would have authority to make some allowances as it's done in the past. Another point is that, of course, they're relying a lot on Category B, but what they actually want to do does not so much relate to Category B meat. What they want to do is take meat that's in Category A, in other words, entirely United States meat, and pretend that it's in Category B. That's what they want to do. They want to label a cow that was, you know, born in Nebraska, raised in Nebraska, slaughtered in Nebraska, slaughtered on the same day as another cow from Canada, and label the Nebraskan cow product of Canada and the United States. And they say that the statute...
That's the commingling issue you're talking about.
But I think there may have been argument is addressed to the commingling issue. Yes, I could be wrong.
Your point is that it's their reading of B has an impact on the language of A.
No, my point is that I think that they're wrong about how they're reading B, at least in terms of ambiguity. But even if you take, let's just say that there was ambiguity in B of the sort that they're talking about, or it was unambiguous and it said you could label Category B meat however you want, that still wouldn't get them where they want to go, because where they want to go, it relates to Category A meat. They want to say Category A meat is product of Canada and the United States. And there's just nothing to say that that's compelled in the statute. I mean, maybe it's permissible in the statute, but to say that it's compelled, that the statute requires the agency to permit a retailer to take a born, raised, and slaughtered cow in the United States and label it as if it came from Canada, the statute cannot be read to compel that. And so, you know, it's not totally clear why Congress used the may have been versus have been, or why they used the precise language they did. But what is clear is that they were dividing the world into four categories in meat. And what's completely clear is A1 of the statute, which says you shall inform consumers of the country of origin of the covered commodity. And to say, well, but Congress unambiguously meant that you could inform consumers of the country of origin of some other covered commodity that was processed on the same day. Just, you can't get that from, at least unambiguously, from this statute.
What about the word may rather than shall? May designate?
I'm not sure exactly what to make of that. It's not totally clear. I mean, may usually implies that there is some alternative to what follows. I don't understand anyone to be saying that they don't have to label it at all, or that they can label it sort of, I mean,
well,
I guess their argument is...
The part that I'm confused about, although I have a reading of it, is the second part of that, of B, which then says nothing in this subparagraph alters the mandatory requirement to inform of country of origin. So the may mean you can go further. You can go further than the mandatory requirements.
It could mean that. Mm-hmm. I think that the next subpart that you've highlighted confirms what we've been saying, which is simply that you can't read the mays in that provision to unambiguously excuse retailers from providing the information, and that's confirmed in the part that you said. I think it would probably be apparent even if that language weren't there. Unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Your Honors, I know I went over my time. I hope I can...
You can.
...rebut for a couple minutes. The government appears no longer to be defending this regulation on the grounds that it offered either in the district court or here with respect to deception. Instead, the colloquy that has emerged over the course of this argument is, if we're actually looking at the statute and if we buy that particular legislative statement and if that means that health and safety actually was an issue, then do we have a kind of constitutional problem? But none of those things really need to be decided in this case. The challenge that we are bringing is to this regulation, and I understand Your Honor's point, Chief Judge Garland, about writing for the next case, but it is possible to write this decision in a way that attacks this regulation, which the government now I don't hear defending, on any ground other than vague consumer interest, which we've already established is not enough under either standard.
Can I pause over the sort of the analytical framework for this, because it has been puzzling me? Imagine that the statute is passed today rather than sometime in the past, so we don't have to figure out which part of the statute matters. And mm-hmm. it says just exactly what it says here, including this introductory part, which says you have to say the source, country of origin, right? And in the legislative history, in the conference committee of both houses, every person on the floor says the reason for the statute is, and then gives these other reasons, health and safety, etc. Is it necessary for the agency to then, when it issues a regulation under the statute, to say, yeah, and we agree with Congress, that's the purpose? Isn't it obvious in the way in which United, Sprint, and Zouder say what's common sense understanding of the purpose, and that when Congress tells you what the purpose of its statute is, that an agency regulating under that statute is following the same purpose?
No, I don't think so for a couple different reasons. The first is, and again, we're now talking again about the statute and not about the reg. We're here challenging the reg. The reg is what's being enforced against us.
That's why I'm asking you, isn't it enough that we know the purpose of the statute when we evaluate a regulation
for constitutional purposes? All we know from this legislative history, though, is that one statement that Your Honor recited. I don't think that's nearly sufficient, but even granting that, mm-hmm. if you compare that, for example, to Milovetz, and I have to part ways with Mr. Tenney on this, the Congress in Milovetz pointed to consumer evidence and information that consumers were being deceived without being told that a debt relief agency actually was one that was just going to help you file for bankruptcy. That is in the record and in the decision itself in Milovetz. That's a critical difference, because what it means is that when Congress imposes on speech and Congress requires disclosure, just like we are arguing here, Congress is put to its proof. Now here, what we are talking about is a regulation that the government no longer is defending on its terms, which the government said was justified merely by suggesting that some consumers like more specific information. That, of course, is a never-ending, infinite set. You can always have, as Your Honors heard in the prior case, more specific information. You could learn the name of the farmer who farmed the beef that led to the packer and processor and led to retail. More specific information is simply not a substantial or compelling government interest under Central Hudson, and that's the standard that has to apply here. The government has backed off Zouderer. It has not defended Central Hudson other than in a footnote. We plainly have suffered irreparable harm either under the First Amendment or economically through the APA, and the district judge's decision should be reversed. There are no questions.
The rulemaking says numerous comments supported the proposed rule and confirmed that certain U.S. consumers value the designation of birth race. Are you saying that's not the case?
No, what I'm saying is that certain U.S. consumers valuing the designation, that goes to the certain U.S. consumers' interest that I mentioned in more specific information. That's the phrase that is the touchstone agencies.
Yes. You're accepting the proposition that you have real consumer, I won't say testimony, but observations.
Comments, evidence, yes.
To the effect that they do value this.
Yes, but what's lacking under Zouderer and Milovetz and Ibanez is any suggestion of consumer deception. So before we get into the Zouderer box, that's what we need.
Your point is just that interest doesn't suffice.
Absolutely not.
That's your argument.
Correct.
I guess it's implicit in your argument that if that's enough, the no limit to what might be enough.
That's exactly right, and that's the point that the Second Circuit made in Amestoy. It's limitless, and that's the point that I mentioned earlier. There is no limit to what more specific information could be required by the government. And to your earlier point earlier, Judge Williams, the market has a way of deciding what information is valuable or not. And here, this market, Joint Appendix 519, even the agency compelling this information understood that the market could solve that particular information gap if it existed by itself. And I think that's a remarkable concession. If there are no further questions.
Thank you. We'll take the case under submission.